And Bruce Dobigan is the editor of Not the Public Broadcaster, who brings a Western perspective to issues. The best-selling author of Cap in Hand is a two-time winner of the Gemini Award. His latest book, Personal Account with Tony Comper, is now available on brucedobiganbooks.ca. And Bruce joins us on Canada Now. And Bruce, it's about that time where I'm going to ask you that we should update that intro to you.
I was just thinking the same thing. Yes, my latest book, as much as I'm proud of my book with Tony Comper, Personal Account, we do have a new book out with my son Evan called Inexact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history. And obviously, I'm very proud of working with my son and very proud of the book. And hopefully, you know, we're going to chat about it a little bit today.
Yeah, let's do that. And we constantly have to change your intros. Well, we got to change them every few months or so because you're like a book machine. But this time, as you mentioned, you have help with your son, Evan, who also joins us on Canada Now. Evan, good to have you on the show.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks, Jeff.
Well, thank you for taking the time as well to join me and your dad. And you guys, as Bruce mentioned, have written a book together called Inexact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history. And you know, Bruce, Evan, it's long been considered that drafting the brightest prospect was key en route to a Stanley Cup victory one day. But Evan, that doesn't always happen that way.
No. Sometimes those aspirations and dreams don't really shake down the way they're supposed to. And as this book shows, you know, there is sort of mention of those kind of players that fell through the cracks in the particular years that we picked specifically. Those kind of gems are mentioned. And, you know, even in years that aren't the ones picked for these chapters, you do get sort of referenced to that, you know, the fact that lots of great players in the draft era have not even gotten there, not even been drafted. They've been signed as, you know, free agents, undrafted free agents, as they call them. So sometimes the best laid plans can sort of fall apart. And that's kind of like an undercurrent in this book, too. It's not just about the big successes and the particular years. Usually that's kind of reason we go into those particular years is that there's great successes and great stories behind them. But then every now and again, there's sort of the kind of players that flopped for teams and cost them the chance to compete for cups down the road. And you really contrast that with the players that did get picked and say, geez, like what went wrong that they, the guy they thought they was going to be the one to lead them to those successes is was nowhere near as good as this guy. And that guy could have been picked many rounds later. So it's very baffling sometimes when you look back on the history of it, but very interesting too.
Bruce, what did it take to, go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah. Jeff. Yeah. I was just going to say one of the things we do with every chapter is we show the draft as it happened, and then we redraft the first round with hindsight. And you know, so you get this amusing thing that you'll look back and you'll see a certain draft and you'll go, well, yeah, they're okay. Yeah. Nick Lidstrom, for instance, was drafted in the 3rd round by the Red Wings. He'd probably be the first overall pick in the 1989 draft. And then some guys, you know, who were up in the top 5 of that draft: Scott Thornton, Dave Chizowski, Stu Barnes. These were all top 5 guys in a year where you could have had Nick Lidstrom at the top. So, you know, to your point, we point out the successes, and we also point out the face plants.
Yeah.
And I love that what-if scenario that you guys play out. Like, what if the Montreal Canadiens had drafted Marcel Dion first overall in 1971 instead of Guy Lafleur? And, you know, Evan, I don't know if it's a little kid in me or what, but thinking about, like, a player, especially, like, an iconic player, slipping on a jersey that he had not worn before, it's rather jarring and so interesting. So to look back and to think of Marcel Dion wearing a Habs jersey, like it would look so odd. I can't help but think about that.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, and I'll let Evan tell the story, but one of the things is, of course, we reveal in the book is that Sam Pollock almost had both guys. He was ready to pull the trigger on a deal that would get them not only the first but the second pick. Tell him the story, Evan.
Well, yeah, Sam Pollock, there's a lot of other examples we can go into that he used his deep farm system and certain draft picks he had to acquire other ones to sort of trade up, as they say. But he seemed to get away with it a lot more back then than you would find a GM be able to do it today, especially because his team was not picking at the top automatically due to where they were finishing the standing. So he was considering, you know, that he was really high on both prospects, as many scouts were, thinking, gee, you couldn't go wrong taking either guy first overall. And so he thought, well, I've already got the LaFleur pick, and there was some, you know, trading that he had done a year before that had helped him land that pick, because it otherwise would have gone to the California Golden Seals. And so he's thinking, well, I've got some more assets. If I throw a bunch at Detroit, could I also have the second overall pick? So he was considering doing that and thinking, well, maybe it'll weaken a little bit of our depth, but then we'll have this amazing center and this amazing winger, and perhaps they could, you know, be the next Béliveau and Geoffrion is what he was, you know, hoping. Of course, in 1971, or now it would seem like, geez, yes, of course that would have been not better, but in 1971 it was almost a little sacrilegious to say such a thing. So he would go around the room with all his trusted, you know, scouts and personnel, top guys, and ask them. He said if one of them didn't believe that or objected to it, he wasn't going to do it. So he didn't get a consensus on that. You know, if I make this trade, give up so-and-so pieces to get Dion, to get that pick from Detroit, and I pick Dion, will they be Béliveau and Geoffrion on part two? And because he didn't really get a clear belief in that, he decided he was better off just keep holding on to his assets and just drafting LaFleur. So it really could have been a really crazy scenario. The Canadians almost would have been too unfair, actually, really, that they would have had those two guys for the bulk of the 70s and 80s, because they ended up teammates briefly in New York, but it wasn't the same by then, obviously, so...
Yeah. Well, and to think about Marcel Dion, like Bruce, like I always thought that Marcel Dion was the most underrated player in hockey. And maybe it was in part because in my years in sports radio, every once in a while, if I wanted to get a really, really good guest, I'd get Marcel Dion because he has so many stories and he's so much fun to talk to. And every time I'd get him, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, you're way too good a player to have been gotten that easy. You answer your phone every time I call you. And it's like you are like the greatest hockey player I could possibly have on speed dial. And to think about the possibility of him being drafted by the Montreal Canadiens playing with Guy Lafleur, I mean, where would his career have gone if that had happened?
Well, just on a personal note, whenever I think of Marcel Dion, I was playing in a charity tournament with Marcel, and I made a particularly bad putt on a hole, and he turned to me and he said, "That was pathetic." So I always think of that with Marcel Dion. But a couple of things about the Dion draft and the LaFleur draft. Up until then, the public in particular, but some people in hockey, just didn't accept that the draft was going to be the way you're going to build. The year before, it had been Gilbert Perreault had gone to Buffalo, a franchise player, a superstar. But this was the year when people sort of slapped themselves upside the head and said, wait a minute, you know, Dion and LaFleur, these are fantastic hockey players we could have. So the 71 draft, I think, and what went on with it is really important because it reinforces for everybody that you can rebuild your franchise immediately if you can get a guy like a LaFleur or Dion. But apropos Dion and the problem, and we talked about it in the book, is Marcel was a fantastic guy in the regular season, assembled fantastic scoring records, etc. In that sense, statistically, probably better than LaFleur over the course of their careers. The problem for Marcel was that, first of all, of course, he was in L.A., so nobody on the East Coast really ever saw his games. And secondarily, they did nothing in the playoffs. His teams were always a flop in the playoffs. So that's where you get greatness in the NHL, is winning Stanley Cups, is people seeing you on Hockey Night in Canada during playoff time. And Marcel, just his teams were never there, and it's really a tragedy.
Yeah. It certainly is. You also explore in the book, Evan, how Wayne Gretzky went undrafted.
Yes, yeah, and this is the famous thing is that, you know, the greatest offensive player ever, you know, arguably, is, you know, a guy that never got picked and obviously would have been a first overall pick. But there is such a perfect storm came together at the time with, you know, the WHA being the rival league and Gretzky entering there first. it's kind of the NHL almost shot itself in the foot in a way that they didn't accept 18 or 19 year olds, teenagers at the time, despite them being, you know, of legal age. And court challenges later sort of helped usher in that era that we now know where 18 and 19 year olds do go in the draft. But the WHA was like, was very on board with trying to help their league, you know, become a fierce rival by bringing in these young players that were still otherwise would have been playing in junior hockey. And Gretzky was one of these coming to the Indianapolis Racers, who lasted very little past when they signed him. And then he was basically sold off for money and a few other players with them in a trade to the Oilers. And that basically punched their ticket to the NHL. As a, when the WHA folded and their best four teams went to the NHL, Gretzky was, of course, the jewel, the shining diamond of the whole entire thing was that the NHL was going to get this guy who had just turned 18 earlier that year. But the problem is that he had signed a personal services contract with Peter Pocklington, who, of course, by then was the majority owner of the Oilers. And there would have been a big, long legal process to try to extricate him from that and put him out into the NHL draft. So they've kind of agreed, okay, you guys can keep Gretzky coming into the NHL. That's fine. We'll just make it simple. And Gretzky is an Oiler still. He doesn't have to re-enter the draft, which other players coming from the WHA who were around his age had to do, such as Mark Messier. As it was, Messier was a member of the Cincinnati Stingers who didn't even really survive the WHA too, so that played a part. But other guys had to be, you know, drafted all over again, or other teams had already drafted in the NHL and had their priority rights. But with Gretzky, he was normally would have been just out there for the worst team in the league to have, which would have been the Colorado Rockies that year. Instead, they end up drafting Rob Ramage first overall, and their franchise just never recovered from having to settle for that over Wayne Gretzky. And of course, the Oilers became the runaway success story of the WHA transfer and all the Stanley Cups they won thanks to this. That they didn't even have to, you know, they got Gretzky to WHA, and then he was automatically on them when they entered the NHL, and they had such a huge advantage over all the three other WHA teams and practically half the NHL by the right from the very get-go. So that's so interesting about 79 is who didn't go first overall that year, not to mention all the Hall of Famers that were picked, actually.
It's probably the best. It's probably the greatest draft year that nobody really realizes it, because you had, as Evan says, you had 18, 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds. Here's the top 10. We redrafted it. But if you were redrafting it today, here are the top 10 guys. You've got Gretzky is not even involved. So you got Ray Bourque, then Mark Messier, Michel Goulet, Glenn Anderson, Mike Gartner, Guy Carboneau, Dale Hunter, Brian Propp, Mats Maslund, and Neil Broughton. That's your top 10 list of a draft. No other draft comes even close to that quality up at the top. It's absolutely remarkable year. And, of course, Gretzky is the cherry on top, not being drafted.
Wow. Now, how did the draft change sports and its business?
Well, the NHL, as I said, took longer to sort of realize the importance of it. We'd seen the NFL draft back in the 60s, and the NBA picked up the draft. But the NHL sort of, you know, they kind of half-assed it a lot. You know, there were a lot of organizations which didn't understand the value of scouting, didn't understand the value of preparing for drafts, and didn't understand basically the value of tanking at the end of a season if you're not going to win the Stanley Cup, etc. So it took a fair bit of time for the NHL to become more sophisticated about the draft and how to do it. Again, Evan was talking about how Guy Lafleur became a Canadian because Sam Pollock was able to make a trade with Oakland that you would never think of making today. So from that point of view, the league really needed a long time to sort of get sophisticated about it and understand the value of draft picks and understand the way to market the draft too, as a, you know, as an off-season event that also gets your fans, gives them something to do 12 months of the year. So they were a little slow on the mark in doing that. And now today, of course, it's much more sophisticated. The pre-testing and all those types of things they do for the prospects is a big deal.
Mm. Evan, will the draft change as we know it in the years to come?
I think so. In that the draft has gone in sort of patterns and trends that evolve as time goes on. And so sometimes it's hard to predict how exactly it'll change. But I do think that there seems to be a movement back toward players based on their skill and ignoring factors such as size and just really looking at the things that have made championship teams in recent years, sometimes you've had teams win and they do it with a lot of, you know, force, a lot of toughness and strength. And that kind of overshadows the talent that is there because, you know, we've looked at champions over the years going way back to the Broad Street Bullies or, you know, the Bruins from 2011 and kind of outlier teams. It seemed like they relied on their intimidation as much as their skill, but we forget that they really also didn't have a lot of skill because, the Bruins are the face of the Bruins winning a Stanley Cup are big guys like Chara and Lucic, but they also had Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand, and they didn't pick those guys right off the top of the draft either. These were second, third round guys who provide you a certain level of skill, but a lot of speed to go with it, the perfect sort of elements to make you an annual contender. And we're seeing that with teams less hesitant to take a guy, even at a position that's known for a little more size and strength, like such as Quinn Hughes, going in the top 10 of the draft. And there were a lot of people questioning it even at the time and saying, I'm not so sure that this guy can hold up in the NHL with that little physique of his being 5'11 and about 170 when he was drafted. And of course, you know, he's not a fully formed product yet, but he is more offensively effective than the majority of defensemen in the NHL. And he just turned 22, like about a couple weeks ago. Or a week ago or so. So he's an example of where the draft might be headed and that people are going to start realizing that size is just something you can target it, but maybe you don't really need it so high up in the draft. Maybe the first thing you need to take care of is getting your team some speed because that seems to be the main thing that gets you to a championship contender.
The other thing in there too, and apropos your earlier question about the draft and how it changed, we deal with this, of course, in the famous Detroit Red Wing draft of 1989, when in the later rounds they pick up Nick Lidstrom, they picked up Fedorov and a couple of other guys. All of a sudden they go global. They figured out that hockey is a global sport, and the Red Wings kind of were the first ones to exploit certainly the Russian players, but also the Swedes. And it made them the best team in the league for 25 years. So the thing with the draft now and where it's going, I think, Jeff, too, is that people realize there's talent everywhere. You're looking at a guy like Austin Matthews who comes from Phoenix. People who come from areas you would have never thought in the past where it was just the Canadian game or even the Canadian and European game. So the world game now is very important to finding talent. And I think that's one of the things you're going to be looking at, teams, organizations, finding guys where nobody else does, from non-traditional hockey markets.
Evan, what did it take to comb through years of hockey history and pick the draft years that you did? I'm thinking that, you know, you have the germ of an idea here to write this book. You two get together on it, and you guys are going back and forth saying, what about this year? What about this year? What about this year? Well, beyond that, maybe to validate those initial choices and to build off of those, what did it take?
Yeah, like I thought about, I didn't know how many years we could narrow it down to be more concise. Of course, I was thinking, oh, maybe we could do 10. Is that okay? Or more or something. And it turned out, well, we could do, you know, fewer years and say more about them. So you're not just giving a kind of glossing over each year to get more in. And so there were some years that obviously would have been in the top 10, but just sort of for various reasons didn't make the cut in terms of the six most interesting ones. I wanted to make it more spread out in a way that it doesn't, you know, there are some times where drafts that are really interesting are clustered together and then you go several years without a good one. So there is 1979, then 84, then 91. Those are sort of clustered together, ones that were picked. And then there you go way late. I wanted to have a more recent one, so I thought 2005 would really stand out. And obviously there's a Sidney Crosby angle to that, but also they were doing the draft in July because of a lockout that had just ended. It was at a hotel. There were so many weird things about it. There was a lottery where every team had a mathematical shot at getting that first overall pick. So a year like 2003, other than 79, might be the greatest draft year ever when you look at who was taken that year. The intrigue going in wasn't quite the same, and it didn't really reveal itself to be a monumental draft until, of course, we could properly assess all the names picked. Because this wasn't 04 where Ovechkin and Malkin were at the top. It wasn't 05 where there was Crosby. It was nobody really knew who could be the first overall pick, and it ended up just being Marc-Andre Fleury, who, you know, has had a very good career but isn't the phenom sort of that we were expecting to see. And in some years, a phenom is expected to go, such as 98, like Vincent LeCavalier, and he did pretty well, but the draft itself was nothing to write home about that year. Or there's a year with a big bust, like Alexander Ding in 1993. But coming so soon off the heels of 91 with Lindros and all the controversy he caused, I thought, well, we'd like to spread it out and make, you know, be more representative of all eras of the draft, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it goes starting at 71, and then we go to 79 and 84, 89, 91, and 2005 to give you more like a broad stretch of years rather than make it too far in the past or too recent as well. So that kind of was sort of the criteria that it broke down to for us, I think.
Jeff, this is the part where I turn into the father and say that there's a reason that Evan's name is first on the title of the book is because it really is his project. I helped him with it. And he's helped me so much on previous books because Evan's a rain man. If there's something you need to know about hockey, it's in his head. And so I can call him up at 2 a.m. and ask a question. Oh, what year did Don Cherry win the Coach of the Year? Was it 79? And Evan will know all this sort of stuff. So this is a culmination of a number of years of his study and his research, et cetera. And, you know, the credit for the book goes to him. I helped him gloss it here, and I provided a talking point for him. But as a father, I have to say that I'm really proud of the work that he's done because, believe me, if you've got a hockey question, he knows the answer.
Well, I was going to ask which of the two Dobigans deserve more credit on this book. I think we all knew the answer to it, and I'm glad, Bruce, you've spelled it out for all of us anyway. Inexact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history. Oh, and I got to say, you know, in the choosing the number 6, it's synonymous for me with hockey because of the original 6 teams. Did that number play a part or that reason play a part in the number of years that you would have picked? Like, Evan, you were talking about it in how many years you should have, but, you know, 6 is a monumental number in the NHL.
I never thought about the, you know, original 6 thing. The coincidence of that never really entered into my mind until you mentioned it, actually. So, yeah. But I think it got narrowed down to, it's kind of a more unique number than picking 5 or 10, you know, intervals like that. So it's somewhere in between. So it's not, you know, 6 or 7 could have been an interesting sort of number to go with. But I think with, you know, talking with my dad and thinking about it, and also with, you know, the people at ECW Press, that's sort of where we narrowed it down to, and we're able to keep, you know, like I said, make representative of every era of the draft. There could have been room for a 7th, but of course then the book would be a bit longer and maybe it would be a little more difficult to, you know, to stick with when you're going through so many different years. And you really do get an encapsulation of the entire history of the draft just by picking those 6 years. It links it together well enough, I think, that isn't a year from the last 15. However, you know, it's hard to also look back at any drafts from the last 10 years and say, you know, the entire story yet, right? Because 2005, it's, you know, written itself out pretty well. Most of the players from that, we know their careers aren't all over, but their legacies have been cemented. It's from everybody from Price to Crosby to Kopitar. But then when we go from 2010 and beyond, we don't know yet exactly. So it's hard to say. But one of those years recent was more interesting too.
We have to be honest with you too. We knew we were going to put Ronnie Ellis on the cover in the number 6 Leaf jersey. So that's why.
Evan and Bruce Dobigan, congratulations on the book again. It's Inexact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history. Thanks to you both for taking the time. Bruce, we'll talk again next week. And Evan, it was a privilege to get to talk to you as well this time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks,
all right.
See ya.
All right, thank you guys. Inexact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history by Evan and Bruce Dobigan.